is tape recording number 5703C13ACC. A lecture by L. Ron Hubbard from the 17th Advanced Clinical Course. Entitled, Technique in Practice. Copyright by L. Ron Hubbard, 1957, with world rights reserved.
And this is the 13th ACC lecture, March the 13th. 1957, 17th ACC. I want to talk to you about the exact application of auditing two PCs and remind you again that you're not very distant from a time when you will be auditing in order to live. And I don't mean as a livelihood. If you can't handle people, you won't make it. And the handling of people is contained exactly in auditing procedures and nowhere else. Man has never had technologies of handling people before. He's gone to tremendous extremes. He's tried to make slaves out of people and whip them and beat them and plow them in and threaten them. And Hitler, in trying to handle people, would seize all their relatives and threaten to kill all them, and it just is fantastic, the measures that man has taken in this anxiety. And those measures were all born out of an unknowing game's condition. Those are immediate products of an anxiety about games and handling people, and they are non-handling activities. And as a result, no handling is ever done. You just get a dwindling spiral going, and it goes right on down. That's about all that happens, about all there is to it. Now, handling people and getting something done at the same time, you find yourself in association with someone, and he isn't doing too well, he's stumbling around the social dwindling spiral in this society, begun already by no control, aided and abetted by radiation, by economic pressure, and by a continually heightened unwillingness to serve one's fellow man, gets into a state where you would find yourself surrounded on every side by a sea of spin. Unless you yourself could take your immediate environment and utilize your knowledge of auditing and control in order to handle your immediate environment. And it is nothing more nor less than auditing procedure. You someday come to think of auditing as not something that you do in an auditing room, but a way of conduct. I'm not trying to enforce a way of conduct on you, even vaguely. As a matter of fact, it's a rather sad thing that I bring this to attention, because one likes to live in a very relaxed frame of mind, certainly. But the truth of the matter is, to live at all, keep a game going, at some time or another, somebody has to get in and pitch. And if you want anything like a straight environment, you will handle it very much as an auditor handles a frequent. It means many things. It means that you don't carelessly give orders. You don't carelessly say, Joe, how about sweeping up around here today? You know? And then tomorrow, you notice that it has not been swept up and forget about it. And that is not the way you would handle it at all. His sweep-up would become consistently worse if you did that. You say, let's sweep up around here today and let it skim for a little while and notice he isn't sweeping up. You're afraid you'll have to go down and find a broom and put it in his hands. He feels better then, by the way. And it's quite remarkable that tumultuous marital situations are 100% resolvable, by the way, by good auditing procedure, just in living. So you might say there's auditing in 2 degrees. And we have never really stressed auditing in the first degree, you might say, in life. We have stressed it in the second degree, which is in the auditing room. This is quite different. A very precise thing toward a precise goal. Auditing, you might say, in the first degree, is a crime which you would execute upon society in your immediate vicinity and make them keep a show on the road and keep rolling and act decently and sanely. Now, let me give you an example of this. You are raising kids. The best way to raise kids, everybody knows, is to not let them have anything they want and give them everything they don't want. One of Dickens's characters running a child nursery and so forth had this as her prime maxim. And you just took everything away from them that they wanted, and you gave them everything they didn't want, and you, of course, had good children. Of course, they were all crazy, and they never amounted to anything, but that was beside the point. They were in a crushed apathy continually. And every time you see a child revolt in any way, of course, punish him. Punish him very hard. And unreasonably, and lay a bunch of holders and bouncers and callbacks and so forth into the established environment. That'll make a good child, good and sick. And if you want to teach him something, why, of course, say that you won't give him any supper until he learns it. That's awfully good. But all of these mechanisms are just added to the various mechanisms which the world has tried and failed in order to raise children or keep a show on the road in any way. No, the man has not evolved a good answer, not until now, and the answer we have works. Works very well. Be nice to a kid. That doesn't have anything to do with letting him get away with murder. Part of you being nice to him is being predictable. And then that way he has a future. And your predictability exists in that you are nice to him. But he can lean on you a bit, because kids need to lean. And when you tell him to do something, the horror of it is, in a fairly cheerful frame of mind, you will go right on through the motions of it without his being able to do anything about it at all. Now, therefore, you don't tell him to do unpleasant things against his willingness. And you keep his willingness in mind when you issue an order. But you don't issue orders carelessly. And if you issue one, you get it obeyed. If you issue an order, you're stuck with it. You issue an order, it's got to be followed. That was your hard luck. You understand? And if you issued an order that was a poor order, it was hard to execute, that's just your tough luck. You'll have to see it through. You tell a little kid that is busy having a rough time of an evening that he must go to bed now. And by golly, you better not tell him he must go to bed now unless you have the time during the next 2 hours to put him back in bed every time he gets up. Cheerfully and pleasantly, but put him back in bed every time he gets up. You told him to. You're stuck with it. Eventually, he'll go to bed. But that's very funny. That really means that children should go to bed, and you're following a now I'm supposed to, and a should be of the society at large. And there's no reason why you should follow that. There's no reason why a child should go to bed. Neither is there any reason why children should annoy adults. There's no reason for that either. Of course, that's the accepted thing these days. See? The purpose, prime purpose of a child is to annoy adults. The use of children in a family is to throw them at callers. Anytime anybody calls, throw the children at them. That's what they're for. But you don't have to be stuck with that one either. And I'll give you an exact example here. Little kid is spinning around and falling on his face and raising cane. You ask him, give him power of choice, you know. You say, now, do you want to sit up there at the table while the rest of us eat, or do you want to go to bed? Well, I want to sit at the table. All right. Sit at the table. And don't tell him, don't even ask him the first question, unless you're prepared to put him at the table. Now you put him at the table. You don't even kneel on the chair. You make him sit on the chair. You put something to eat in front of him. And you don't care whether he eats it or not, because it's not an order to eat to put something in front of him that can be eaten. And you could complicate the situation entirely. He really has not settled the first auditing command when you tell him, now eat your dinner. You got two commands going at the same time. Dead wrong. You haven't gone quietly at the table yet. He's up off the chair and down on the floor again. And you pick him off the floor and put him back in the chair again. Pat him on the head and tell him you're very fond of him. That's fine. Good. He's up off the chair and down on the floor and he tells you, I want to go to bed now. You say, that's fine. Sit down in the chair. And if no anger, since I don't think kids are very hard to handle, I don't really see any reason to generate very much anger. If no anger is imposed against him, he will be quite amazed that within 4 or 5 minutes, certainly, why, he will be sitting at the table, and he will now be interested in sitting at the table, and seems rather relieved that somebody made him do something, even when his mind changed his mind for him. All right, now he's sitting at the table. You say, now there's some milk there. Drink your milk. No, I don't want to. Well, now, it's not up to you to go over and pour milk down his throat, but it is certainly up to you that at the time he leaves the table, the milk glass is empty. You've given him an order. See that it's obeyed. All eating orders are contained with great deal of liability because they have all sorts of kickback. Your anxiety about somebody's eating, unless the person is just passing out the bottom for lack of food, should not be very great. In the morning, a free clear should have eaten. His metabolism is too low to be properly audited. This is for sure. But you're really not auditing somebody. You're really bringing some peace into the environment. Very funny thing. After you've made this a practice for a little while, this little kid will be happy, cheerful. He will like you. He will like himself. And he will follow through in a much more social pattern than before. No anger on your part, just an auditing attitude. If you're a good auditor, you can get away with it. If you're a good auditor, you'll have some peace and have some randomity at your choice. And your environment will have some survival in it. And if you're a bad auditor, you won't. You all of a sudden blow up and say, God damn it, I said sit down at the table. What the hell is going on around here, you little brat? There's no reason why you should follow such an order at all. You've declared war. You have said you are not a teammate. You have said you are an opponent. You have said we are now going into an unknowing game's condition, which shall continue the remainder of this evening. You ran up the flag of no quarter, and believe me, he will answer it on his flagstaff. Yep, that is the optimum way to handle children, I know, according to many authorities. Now, this idea of the child doing everything, and by the way, this isn't a lecture on children, this is a lecture on preclears, and I'm just using children to demonstrate it, to give you another point of view. And this child theory today that says that everyone should let the child express himself is probably the most destructive thing you can do to children. They don't really mean expression. What they mean is you do not inhibit the child in any way. You do not place any control in his vicinity. If he's screaming, you let him sit in the middle of the floor and scream. If he's hanging by his heels from the chandelier, you let him hang. If he's tearing up your favorite book, let him tear it up. That is self-expression as expressed today in modern child theory. Well, we're more modern than that. And I can assure you that makes very unhappy children. Now, here's where we move into technique. If you run a preclear on this one, you will at once become conversant with this whole problem. Mock up somebody and deny him control. not necessarily the most therapeutic technique in the world. It's a, to be very technical, it's a bitch kitty as far as action and automaticity is concerned. But it tells you that it's a game condition because it runs. It audits. Mark up somebody who's denying control, and you go right back to old flip-flopping. Remember, we found flip-flopping was therapeutic way back when, years ago. Mark up somebody making flip-flop. Mark up somebody making flip-flop. Well, this is it. This was why flip-flopping. It wasn't the motion. It was the denial of control. And that becomes one of the wildest things that you ever tried to run on somebody. Particularly somebody who believes that a child should always be permitted to express himself. The innate rights of every human being to do exactly as he pleases, whether it causes murder, upset, foreign wars, or unrest. That whole philosophy is simply born, you will discover, out of a deep, degraded apathy. Well, I cannot control anything, therefore I shall invent a philosophy by which no control is ever necessary. Feeling of irresponsibility will turn on in the pre-clear, which is his feeling toward the society in all dynamics. And you can turn that irresponsibility on directly with that particular technique. Mark up somebody and deny him control. And he feels all of a sudden terribly irresponsible, and then suddenly realizes the way he feels toward people. Only now you've heightened it up and you've raised it upscale a little bit so that he can detect it as a sick irresponsibility. He feels sick over this. You're having a mock-up of mob. It's never good to audit mobs particularly, but you have to if you're going to get by the third and fourth dynamic. And you'll get his complacent feeling that everybody in the government is doing all right and everything is doing all right and everything is going along in this best of all possible worlds, running out has a rather heady charge. It's quite amusing. Mock up the government and deny it control. We find this fellow who is obsessed with the fact that he must change the entire organization with which he's connected, which isn't running too badly. He's obsessed with changing it. He could not do anything else but change it. And he does the inversion. And this is an interesting one to observe. And the inversion is that the obsessed change starts right in as a terrific automaticity. Mock up somebody, deny him control. And he gets this obsessed. He'll mock up that organization and deny it control. And he gets an obsessed automaticity. And then that runs right straight out to apathy, of all things, and comes upscale from apathy. In other words, he denied it control, and finally inverted to a must control it, but can't. And that across a bridge of apathy left him a very unhappy person. But a natural and more normal state, that I say normal, I apologize, say, more acceptable state as far as we're concerned, is somebody who can or need not. He can, but he doesn't have to. The willingness to control is what we are trying to achieve here. In other words, we're not trying to achieve this obsessed control which sends these Hitlers out to crush all of mankind and that sort of thing. If you were to run Hitler on this, he certainly would have gone through several degrees of fit. Mock up the world and deny it control. And you would have gotten automaticity, the world flying all over the sky. That would have been an automaticity to end all automaticities. And eventually, you would have gone into complete apathy running it. You would have felt sick, degraded, upset, and eventually would have come through on the other side with a much higher concept, that is, that he could control Earth. Therefore, anything that the German Reich undertook would have been constructive as far as man was concerned, not destructive. For lack of one auditor, 30 million people died. It's interesting to look at these things. What you know is not unimportant. All right, now let's take the other two sides of this. You often ask yourself the question, should I communicate or should I not communicate? Communication will as is his having. This is perfectly true. He has the consideration that his having this will go to pieces if he is given too much communication. But remember, it is only an obsessed communication, not really a perfect communication, that upsets him. If you let a person talk compulsively, in other words, dramatize a talking engram, he will suffer for it. But good two-way communication conducted with great precision to its parts really doesn't knock it apart. You understand that? And if you want an example of this, then we will take another denial process, mock up somebody and deny him communication. You'll probably find out this was his favorite method of handling his mother or his father or his school teachers. Mock him up and deny him communication. He would deny them communication and then they would seek communication from him. Quite interesting. It's run as a games condition, mock up somebody, deny them communication. Now, don't be amazed if the mock-up blanks out. Of course, the mock-up is being denied communication, and therefore, part of the communication is visio. And people with bad eyes have uniformly denied too many people communication. And that is all there is to it. And people who don't have mock-ups can't see facsimiles, are stuck on one of these communication denial things. And this changes and shifts around and runs out. That is not the best process in the world by which to handle every bricklayer. I'm not getting it to you as such. I'm just getting it to you as a very important process and particularly useful in demonstration of what life is all about. Now, everything goes blank, black screens come up, and gets all sorts of automaticities occurring, which are the automaticities of denied communication. Quite an interesting process. Now let's take another process along in the same line that I've already spoken to you about. Let's mock up somebody denying havingness. Now that is a process. Why? Because we have a tolerance factor in havingness that we can improve, and it is rather uniformly workable on all preclairs. Not so controlling communication, the processes could, to some slight degree, be above the ability of the preclair to conceive, but not so havingness. Just as we know, havingness sits on that CCH formula. All parts of the CCH formula work on the same process, deny, but denial of havingness can work a miracle cure for you. Quite interestingly, some fellow has a withered leg, you have him mock up people or a person, no designation of sex, mock up a person, deny him a leg. And the next thing you know, why you find out why the old overt act motivator sequence engrams ran. Or didn't run. Quite amusing to see somebody come out of a psychosomatic illness with considerable speed on that particular process. Turns off fevers, does all sorts of interesting things. It's a senior process to most other processes that you know. Now, here are each one of these things called communication, control, and havingness. All of them runnable demonstrably on mock-up somebody and deny him communication or in another process control or in another process havingness. And we find that havingness is the more workable in the earlier stages of auditing, but the other two come into their own as you go upscale. Therefore, you would suspect that this would run similarly on the tone scale, that if the least usable of them was communication, mock up somebody and deny him communication, And the intermediately usable one was mock up somebody and deny him control. And the most usable one was mock up somebody and deny him havingness. And you are liable to get a much better idea of why and where and how come these things work. Well, oddly enough, the entrance to control happens to be controlling him. You're showing him that a body can be controlled. Well, now, controlling a person absolutely directly without any recourse to his self-determinism produces a situation which is not particularly desirable. But you, by communication, sneak him out of that when you're doing control on him. You tell him to do something, then you make his body do it, and then you thank him for having done it. Now, remember, there's a trick in this controlling of his. That's a trick. It is not a simple statement that if you control people, they get better. True enough, if you control them predictably, they do better, but they don't particularly get better. You have to add this little trick. You have to assign the responsibility for the control to the thing. And that is the trick in running control and in controlling human beings. And a human being controlled in that fashion, whether a little child or a workman or an executive or anything else, will better under the process. You say, put that paper down on your desk and make sure that he does by pressing his hand down. Make sure that the body does. You see, it's the loose use of he, I think, which is getting in the road here. And then you thank him for having done so. Now, you identified the source of the command. He has never been able to identify where all these odd impulses were coming from, but he's identified one now. Therefore, he's given a certainty for an exterior command. But he himself is flattered or evaluated into a belief that he himself could have accomplished it all by himself on direct order. No further mechanics. Now, remember, that is the trick of Scientology control, and that makes it cut in very low on the scale. But you're handling havingness when you're running something like that. You are handling havingness. Okay. You are communicating with the person, with the Thetan, and you are exerting start, change, and stop. And so you're handling C, C, H all at the same time. Now, more esoteric considerations occur at once to a rather, well, a brilliant auditor in good condition. He immediately can conceive such a thing as, well, if that is true, why not mock up somebody and deny him determinism? Well, that's with ability on a very high scale case. But determinism itself is a concept which is too far, far beyond most preclears. They depend utterly upon the proofs of mass. And depending utterly upon the proofs of mass, some esoteric combination which gives this significance undemonstrated does not communicate to them at all. In other words, thoughts are no longer traveling on that channel, but the movements of mass can be. It's true that this has a workability up along the level of latent exterior. It doesn't have workability otherwise. All right. Now, thus we have a number of things pointed out here that I talked to you about yesterday. That CCH, each one audits on its own, in its own sphere. You can't audit each part of that directly. And you would expect to, if you were handling these three things as very powerful things, that any use of them would result in some result or another in auditing. And that is very true that it does. That's the first thing I wish to point out to you. The next thing I wish to point out to you is that a technique is only as good as it improves an existing ability of the preclear. A demonstrable ability, I should say. Where do you pick up a preclear? Well, you pick him up at something he can do and let him do it better. Let him do it more positively and more consistently. That is of primary importance. If you miss that one, you'll always be a lousy auditor. You won't be worth helping. Yet I've seen auditors miss this consistently.
They think it's the technique. The technique is going to do everything. Oh, no, it is not. You must isolate, observe, note, consciously tag an ability of a preclear, and then improve that ability. I'll give you an idea of bad obnosis, how obnosis fits into this. Really horrible obnosis. Take a person without any arms. Well, let's say, all right, put your hands on the table. He can't put his hands on the table. He knows that. Requires the via of mocking them up or growing new ones or something of the sort. And the vias are just too many and it just looks too formidable. And at that moment, he rather goes into a slump. Wouldn't he? Put your hands on the table. No, no. That is not his ability. Well, let's take a psycho and let's find out that a psycho can sit down. His obnosis, this is, gets so elementary that it just bypasses one and all. A psycho can sit down. Then the process to be improved is sitting down. You understand that? But you say, but I can sit down. It isn't any ability to be achieved at all. Yes, there is. You can have the psycho make himself sit down. Now, he already can do it. He's doing it on some machine automaticity, and you've got to bring it into a present time ability, which he recognizes as something that he could be cause in. You bring it into a sphere where he can be causative, and you remove it from a sphere of impulse to causation. But he knows he can do this. He knows this can be done. Let me put it that way. Better. He knows it can be done. He knows that it is within the realm of some possibility for him to do it. And you, the auditor, make it possible for him to do it, and the case betters. Auditors are never satisfied with these little tiny jumps. Those are the important jumps, however. They're never satisfied with them. They're always raiding around waiting for somebody to get to be an OT and mock up three vases with flame in them in the middle of the room. Well, that's fine. Maybe that's your ambition. But did you ever stop and think that maybe the highest ambition of one of your pre-clears is simply be able to go to sleep at night? Just as stupid as that. Terrific ambition, little kid. Little kid wishes and hopes and thinks about and concentrates on being able to tie his own shoes. His goals are so tiny that an auditor habitually overlooks them or holds them in contempt as being not worth achieving. And there's failure at once. I think it was the Emperor Theodosius who was so roundly thrown into power in Constantinople after the great incursion of barbarians across the Danube. But in any event, the emperor he took over from had been killed on the field of battle with most of the Roman army. The barbarians had come across and they had simply made mincemeat through strategy and tactics and so forth on the entirety of the Roman army. A few fragments withdrew and got into a fortified place, but the barbarians were possessors then of all the country north of Constantinople and easily could have come down and knocked on the gates anytime they wanted to, and it was practically the end of the Western Empire and certainly was the beginning of the downfall of the Eastern Empire. It was a very dark day in the Roman Empire. From that point on, Roman troops would not confront barbarians. You could not get Roman troops to confront the idea of going out and fighting a pitched battle with barbarians. They gathered up levies of one kind or another in order to defend Constantinople. And Theodosius, having taken over, I think it was he, conceived an interesting notion. He felt the only way that the empire would ever again be able to rise would be if its armies were able to confront the barbarian hordes and run sort of a police action north of the city, at least. So he would gather together all the soldiers he could lay his hands on anybody could put into uniform. And by an intricate spy system and paying off enormous awards, he would find where a couple of barbarians were isolated. With pillaging and so forth, had fallen away from the main command. And send 1,000 troops thundering in on their heads. Of course, that was the end of 2 barbarians, just like that. But there were thousands and thousands of barbarians out through the countryside. He was very careful. He made them win every action. Actions against a squad, actions against one single forager. And eventually, they swept the barbarians out of the northern provinces. But it was on that tiny scale. Theodosius was revered above any other emperor before or after him to a very marked degree. Now here is perhaps a long ago and terribly unapplicable example out of dead and dust history. But that's kind of the condition your Freakler is in. He is totally swamped, he feels, by barbarians. Did you ever have a Freakler tell you that demons haunted him all night? But if he could just handle these thoughts about God or about something of the sort, he'd be all right. Well, whether he's a Freakler or a soldier, or a Roman soldier, or a barbarian being put back on his feet, doesn't matter. He's a human being and he's under invasion of some sort or another. Thought is invading him. He's being invaded with thought, very terrible. He's being invaded by cruel thoughts. He's being invaded by hate, contempt, and many other things. He's being slugged around until he's the only trooper left in the entire universe. And he himself is divorced from any part of the mess which he thinks he should control. He doesn't even control his right hand thoroughly. There's some question about that. He sits down to write a letter, and he does not himself know whether he is writing the letter or it is being written by the ghost of his dead grandfather. He's defeated. He's a defeated trooper. Now, that's about the way you should look him over. Not because I have had too much experience with the military. Not because the world is one of tooth and claw. But because in a world of disorder, one at length cannot isolate the sources of anything. And one goes down on an inability to conceive what is attacking him. Now, any technique that will locate an isolated barbarian and throw 1,000 troops down on his neck and will let the Freakler know that this happened is a good technique. Therefore, we are not looking for the all techniques which unwind every thought in the bank. We are not looking for interestingly intricate techniques that are very tricky and turn on a lot of automaticity and do this and that. To some degree, these are fun. We're just looking for something that will give the Freakler a tiny win and let him know it. Now, the technology required, the self-discipline on the part of an auditor, if there is such a thing, or the relaxedness on the part of an auditor. What is required to do that one thing is rather tremendous. You see, when you make a simple motion repetitively to a Freakler with your hand and ask him to mimic this simple motion repetitively with your hand, he may know that no two motions can ever be alike. And the whole thing may become entirely unreal to him. It's just beyond his ability to duplicate a simple motion. That is no victory. Well, if a person is in that condition, he doesn't conceive that he can execute a single motion of any kind. He himself cannot execute a single motion of any kind, and you're giving him a repetitive motion that he is supposed to mimic or indicate, and mimic it. That's something new, too. He doesn't even know that he could sit in a chair himself on his own determinism. You're asking him to move. You get the idea? I mean, his ability may be so microscopically small, the ability which he, a Thetan, can master, may be so microscopically small in your estimation that you just overlook it entirely. And particularly since these are always the people who were there evaporating, instead of you, that their ambitions are tremendous in auditing. What are your goals in auditing? This fellow that doesn't know who sat him in the chair, or whether he's going or coming, or who's talking to him, or what circuit's running next, will always tell you his goal for this intensive is to be an operating Thetan. At least. Big ideas and no ability. Don't you go looking at those big ideas. I don't know which of the seven entities of the body you're talking to, but it's one of them. There's a guy there. There's somebody present. And what can he do? And the worse off he is, the less he can do and still win. You ever think that maybe an auditing command such as look around the room and find something might be a tremendous win for Prinkler? Just look around the room, find something. Not do anything with it, not be specific about it at all. Or tell me something that is in this room. Tell me something that you know is in this room. Then we evolve it out to just about its lowest possible statement, which is that. But oddly enough, some part of this person or Prinkler is in communication with you. But the reality scale tells us that a communication, if it is real at all, if you respond at all, communication would go upscale if it found a solid line. So sitting and talking to somebody at 4 or 5 feet away and asking him to do intricate things, even such as look around the room and find something, maybe far above his ability to execute. I'm talking about his ability, not his plus machinery, plus bank, plus entities, plus demons, devils, past, and body. Okay. Talking about his ability. Give me some kind of an idea of how this goes. I was feeling rather tired the other night for some peculiar reason. I didn't feel like... I felt my mechanical aptitude was very poor, for some reason or other. I was tired. I consistently failed to take a set of spark plugs out of a motor. I didn't have any tools with which to do it. You can't gnaw them out with your teeth, but not having any tools, and having only elementary tools, I had failed to do this and so forth. So I just felt, lost. I didn't have anything with which to do the job. I sat there for a while and finally figured out a combination of wrenches I did have, something like Rube Goldberg's old drawings, and then applied them to the problem and found out why I couldn't get them out, because they'd been put in with some kind of a wrench, which evidently had two sides, two arms. With full strength. This is not the way you put in spark plugs, by the way, but some mechanic had done this. And he put them in there much more solidly than you put lugs on wheels when you change the tire. And I got those spark plugs out, and I put some other spark plugs in. All of a sudden, I didn't feel tired, and I felt fine. And I look back at this as an objective oddity. This was an oddity. Now, that was a particular and peculiar sphere of action. I don't pretend to be a mechanic, and I have no tool shop of any kind. But I've actually done this stupid thing of changing a set of spark plugs in a modern motor. Now, one would not expect this to do anything on a long basis, because there's really nothing too much wrong on that line. But here was the oddity. I was tired. Before I did it, but when I did it, I was no longer tired. You get the tiny little finite jump that a person gets on any win, no matter how idiotic. And that certainly was an idiotic whim. There wasn't even any reason for me to do it. It was just me being ornery about it. I could have taken past any garage, and they would have whipped out the spark plugs and thrown some new spark plugs in there while I was drinking a Coke. You get the idea. No great change of sanity, unfortunately, took place, but a state of tiredness changed. Now, you, in auditing a preclear, very often overlook something. They're not tired because they've been racked around and running up and down and doing this and that and wearing themselves out in general and got everything in re-stimulation. They never had a chance to sit down and they missed their lunch and breakfast. And you just put really the stress on the thing and we get this tremendous degree of tiredness that you would get from an actual and immediate causes. No, they're just tired and they don't know why. They're tired from some exercise they took when they were 10. See, different thing. They're just worn out. All right, you give them any tiny little win in life that they know they did, and to that degree, they start snapping out of it. I turned on a preclear's mock-ups for him once and didn't think I was going to do very much. I asked the preclear what the preclear could mock up. The preclear said nothing, as usual. I kept asking the question, and the preclear finally said, finally, he was looking at some blackness, and he thought he could put some more blackness in it, and that was all I needed. It wasn't that one then cleared up the blackness. It was a demonstration to the preclear that what he mocked up was actual enough to remedy having this with. And I had the preclear mocking up blackness and remedying having this with it. One right after the other. Preclear went out of 10 and a few other things. We kept up the process. And at the end of that time, the preclear could get something like a mock-up. It was just that tall. Went ahead and improved this ability now. Improved the ability to remedy hattiness. Tremendous change in this person. This enormous change took place in this person. Greater competence. No more peevish tears about how cruel life was. These were actual, observable, provable wins. Well, you're perfectly willing to take a black case and just chew on it and chew on it and chew on it and let him chew on it and chew on it and chew on it and chew on it and change the thought pattern around in that black case. Well, by golly, you can do a lot. Says a lot for Scientology. You can even do a lot doing that. But how about something spectacular by turning it all white? That's what a little black and white was. You finally got people who could turn a black field white, and they said, I can do something to it. You showed them that they could render an effect, Axiom 10. You showed that they could therefore be cause. You showed them that they could achieve something. And from that tiny little gradient on up the line, you won all the way. But too many auditors are auditing on another premise entirely. They're auditing a person the way they fix a radio. They say a tube is blown out, we'll get the tube lighted again. They don't consult with the preclear. They just fix the machine. They change the spark plugs. That does an auditor a lot of good, but it doesn't help the preclear at all. You've seen the case. But you just changed all over the place. You took away his arthritis, and you gave him this, and fixed him up that way, and got him so he could actually look at women, and changed his appearance, and so on. And the fellow never said a word to you about it. That was because no time during the session did you actually audit the preclear. Well, I would be ashamed to admit that I, as a Thetan, could not change the simpler characteristics of the body. I'd be ashamed to admit. Simpler characteristics of the body has some minor ill. I'd be ashamed to admit that on my own, that I couldn't knock that out. Guy has a stomach ache. And if I couldn't change the stomach ache without talking to him about it, I'd feel ashamed of myself. And too many people use auditing just to do that. They change the stomach ache, they don't change the guy. Now, if you change the stomachache and he finds out about it, you may have an improvement because you may have more altitude and now more believable and therefore can give orders that he will accept better, and so control on the case will be better, and this then exercised would improve the case. You got the idea. But that's a long way around from what you may have thought about this before. You thought, well, now, if I fix up this fellow's corns and he doesn't have corns anymore, he'll be eternally grateful and he doesn't even notice now he hasn't got corns. He hasn't got corns, but he doesn't notice it because you didn't audit the preclear. You audited this machinery or his mass or his structure in some fashion without consulting him at all. So just controlling a body will, of course, change the conditions of a body, making a body move here and move there and go through some exercise on the positive direction command, gives the body as a mass some future, and does, of course, change the body. But if you want to make the case better, you have to tell the person to do it, then make sure the body does it, and then thank the person. You've got to include him in on it. If you don't, he won't ever improve. Now, we patch up somebody's arthritis, something like this. Oh, yes, he very often feels very happy about it, but just as often feels very unhappy about it. Something has been changed about him without his consent. You've altered his service facsimile. He didn't like this. Nothing to make his wife feel sympathetic for him anymore or something, you know. In the first place, arthritis wasn't what was wrong with him. What was wrong with him was he could not have control or communicate with a body. And one of the more obvious expressions of this was arthritis. But the obvious thing is the fellow wasn't doing it. And as you walk a fellow around, you will notice he's not controlling himself. As he walks into the office, you can tell he's not controlling himself rather easily. This observation, it's up to a Scientologist to notice this. So what does technique boil down to? It isn't the technique that will solve all the problems of mankind's wish. It is the technique that will better this particular preclear. And the gradient scale of doing that tells us that it is a technique which will then give him a consistent number of wins that he can recognize as wins, a consistent number of orders that he can execute and recognize as orders and recognize that they were executed. And this then gets to be a tiny little thing. And we have such a thing as 8C, still the most popular technique in Scientology. Still is. You can add keep it from going away to it. You've still got 8C. You can add hold it still. You've still got 8C. You can add have and can't have, and you've still got 8C. I mean, you're doing 8C, marching somebody around the room predictably and acknowledging the fact that he did. And the fellow finds out of all the things that he can rock. Now, 8C undercuts SCS. SCS is a better exteriorization technique than it is a beginning technique. And anybody who can do 8C actually, you know, the auditor can just walk the guy's body around too, and the fellow never finds out about it. But an actual 8C can start a case. Can start a case. And to blow him out of his head, you could go up into Stop CS or some such thing. Way up the line. But if a fellow ever turned on somatics in doing 8C, you're stuck with it. No matter what kind of 8C you were doing, you had it. Fellow start to turn on somatics and change and alter around in various directions and so forth, there is something happening. He is aware of the fact that somatics are happening because he told you so. Therefore, he is aware of change occurring one kind or another. And he is trying to decide whether or not he has anything to do with it. And you have to give him some simple command that he can execute and carry along with. And that simple command is something like walk over to the wall. Now, HC is an objective process. It doesn't concentrate on the body, it concentrates on the wall. And it's usually true, unless you're simply trying to get the preclear under control with old Start CS, it's usually true that a person would have to be able to have all things in the room and have his body not have all things in the room with great accuracy before Stop CS started to come up to its peak and really work. Because if it's really working, it'll just blow somebody out of its head. There's nothing you can do with that. But remember, he is concentrated on the body, and HC concentrates him on the wall via the body. So it's an extended objective process. What can your pre-clear do and know he's doing? Well, you will find that. On a lower case, one kind or another, you will find that it lies in the realm of controlling something. And you, by controlling the something or controlling him, get him at length to control something. Don't think that a small object is necessarily the answer as easy as to control. He may just control this on an automaticity. On one pre-clear I well remember, I told him to pick up a large, heavy library table. That was the auditing command. Pick up that table. Well, it had enough mass and enough weight so that he knew it was there. Put a little light ashtray, or a cigarette lighter, cigarette pack, something of this character. He did not have enough mass there to convince him it was there at all. Well, a fellow like Hitler's got to have the entire mass of Earth before he knows something is there. In other words, the worse off they get, the more mass it takes to convince them. Thus, we get techniques. And when you think about techniques, think about this. What can the pre-clear do? And how can I develop a control process that matches that? And you will have started every case that you find anywhere. Because a control process brings in, of course, communication. And it will bring in, inevitably, havingness, one way or the other. People can have what they have some ghost of a chance of controlling. They can't have much else. And when you are reaching for bottom on a pre-clear, you don't seem to be making speed on a pre-clear, don't think you need some more powerful technique. You only need one that the pre-clear can, under your solid and heavy control, do and know he is doing. That's what you need. You don't need some genius of a technique that steps in and stirs his brains up and swamps his skull out and cleans him all out with Santa Flush. This is not what you need. What you need is something that will give the pre-clear a thetan, handling a body, a win. And when you've done that, you've reached as far south as you can go. And it may only be in a comatose person, an ability to squeeze your hand back after you've squeezed his hand. That might be that low. Person's evidently comatose, out of communication with everything. You go in and you squeeze his hand every day. He eventually squeezes your hand back. You win him, he's on his way. That was the technique necessary to resolve the case. The technique necessary to resolve the case in all cases is demonstrating control is possible that can be transferred over to the action of the pre-clear. And that is the technique that wins. Thank you.